But looking at the world today, we've got approximately 1987, the population will be 5 billion plus. 35% of that 5 billion are under the age of 16 years old. And now, what I'm trying to do is give you an overview and a picture of what's going on in the world, what's going on in society, so you can understand the society that we're trying to penetrate and the different age groupings and so on. Life expectancy worldwide is rising to 62. So we know that we're going to have to we're going to have a much larger, older population, and we're going to have to really figure out how to penetrate there. The population is doubling every 41 years. Some of you will be alive to see 10 billion people plus on this planet. It's going to be awfully crowded. Now, looking into the past 20 years, basically the number of missionaries worldwide has been unchanged. For the last 20 years, the total number of missionaries out there trying to do the job basically is unchanged in numbers. And 95% of the total missionary workforce in the world ministers only to 5% of the population. 95% of all missionaries in the world are only ministering to 5% of the world's population. And some of that is because, of course, there are closed countries and difficult places to get in. Others, it's because that's where they've chosen to minister. Which means, if you take the reverse of that, that only 5% of our total missionary force are trying to reach 95% of the world's population. Interesting, isn't it? By the year 2000, 71% of all the countries in the world will be closed or restricted. That is, to the traditional missionary endeavor. We will not be able to get people into certain countries as traditional missionaries. They'll have to go in using tent making as their entree into some of those countries. Here's one that is rather staggering. U.S. missionaries are retiring four times faster than new recruits are entering the field. Of course, as you well know, the U.S. carries the greatest burden and percentage of missionaries worldwide. But of our missionaries, because a lot of them were thrust out in the 30s, 40s, 50s, now coming home and retiring, they're retiring four times faster than we're able to recruit new ones going out. Here's one. Four countries in the world constitute half the world's population. If we could get into these four countries, we could cover half the world's population. In China, India, USSR, and Indonesia. And of course, as you know, they're either closed or somewhat restricted to our missionary endeavor. But those four countries alone constitute half of the world's population. Exciting things are happening in China, by the way. You know, at 10 years ago, you would never have dreamed that you could get into China. But some missiologists believe that when China closed, when the communists took over, there were approximately 900,000 Christians in China. Today, the conservative estimate, because the church went underground and into homes and began to spread that way, conservative estimates say that there are 30 million Christians. And somewhere, some of them go up to 50 million in terms of their estimations as to how many Christians there are. Now, that was with the country closed. Now, the crack in the door is opened, particularly for tent-making-type missionaries, engineering, teaching, doctor, so on. The door is opening in China, and we need to take advantage of that as an opportunity that God has put before us. Here's Christians to the world population. That is, as a percentage, the number of Christians has remained constant since the 1900s. There has been no significant increase in the number of Christians in the world as a percentage of the population. Protestants, in fact, have dropped from 9.4% in the 1900s to 7.9% of the total world population. So the Protestant population is decreasing. Non-religious atheists have increased from 0.2% since 1900 to 21% of the world's population. Non-religious atheists. All of your secularism is rising out of this whole movement. And so you can see that this is not just when you read different articles in Christianity Today and Moody and so on about secularism. It's not something that's happening over there. It's happening here. It's happening around the world. It is a movement that is really growing. And we've got to deal with it if we're going to be serious about. Here's another one. Muslims in the 1900s constituted 12.4% and have risen to 16.5%. And by the year 2000, they estimate that almost 20% of the world's population will be Muslim. And that's fanatical Muslim. You know, the Ayatollah type Muslim faith. And they are really out to evangelize the world. And they've got the money and the oil reserves to carry out their little program. Here's another phenomenon that's happening. Again, it's something that we've got to deal with, and I'll show you some more statistics on the U.S. in a moment. Urbanization worldwide. In Africa, super cities of 4 million plus will rise from 1 today to 12 by the year 2000. Of 4 million plus. There are 7 Islamic cities that will reach 10 million by the year 2000. 10 million in one city. And those are 7 of the cities that will have a population of 10 million fanatical Muslims living within one boundary. There may be a few Christians thrown in there, but super cities of a million or more will grow from 276 worldwide to 433 by the year 2000. Now, all this is just to show you that the world is moving toward urbanization. The rural setting is dissolving, and everything is moving into the cities. Let's move now into a little more specific about the U.S. In a recent survey, this was a breakdown given of the makeup of the 230 or 40 million people here in the U.S. The unreconciled secular, about 38% of our population, are unreconciled secular. Unreconciled religious, about 40% of our population. And that would include all of your cults, all of that area. Reconciled church, active, about 11% of our population, and reconciled church, inactive, about 11%. So you can see that we're really in a minority, aren't we? About 22% of our population. I don't know where Gallup gets all of his statistics and figures, but I think some of them are a little too general. And most of this stuff has been listed out of very legitimate surveys done by in-depth. And I tend more to go with this in my feeling for what's going on in the U.S. I think this would be more reflective of our society. Urbanization in the U.S. by the year 2000, 83% of all of our population will live in cities. Right now, 74% live in cities. So again, the same phenomena that we see happening worldwide is happening here in the U.S. And all that is to say that the church better not desert the cities. And of course, as you well know, that's what happens. If you're in an inner city church, pretty soon it moves to the far suburbs and waits for everything to grow up around it. And the inner cities have been basically deserted by the church. And we've got to rethink that whole strategy. There are 171 cities of 100,000 plus. That's not too big a job, is it, when you start thinking about that? If we could plant effective disciple-making ministries in 171 locations, we'd cover all of the major cities in the U.S. 42% of the U.S. growth in the 70s was in three states, California, Texas, and Florida. They were the states that grew the most in terms of population movement and so on. Of course, you know this. Whites favor cities of under 250,000. Minorities favor cities of over 250,000. Now, I don't think they favor it. That's where they have to be. That's where the low-paying jobs are, and they're forced into those kind of situations. There's some things here on Hispanics. 84% live in cities of 250,000 plus. 35% of all Hispanics are in California. In our division, which is what we call the Western Division, we have 75% of all the Hispanic population in the U.S. is in our division, because we go over to Texas. We pick up Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and then go all the way west. And 75% of all the Hispanic population in the U.S. is in our division. So just strategically, in terms of what do I do with my time, a lot of it is spent thinking through some of these kind of issues. And, of course, you know that Larry Blake, Larry and Joan, just about a year and a half ago, stepped out of their responsibility and moved into heading up a thrust into the Hispanic population, and to begin to learn some of those lessons for us and begin to recruit staff for that whole area of our population. Okay, this one, some of this stuff here is rather interesting, I think. There are more people today, there are more people over 65 than there are teenagers. There are more people in the U.S. today over 65 than there are teenagers, and that trend will continue to increase. Of course, part of that has to do with the lowering of the birth rate and abortion, and all of these kinds of things are affecting our society. But also, as a church, as a body, we've got a whole new area to think about in terms of legitimate ministry. And we've got a manpower pool here of people that really could do something significant for Christ if we can harness it, if we can get in there and disciple and raise up laborers. 82 million, or one-third of the population of the U.S., is over 50. And just an interesting side note, these control one-half of the discretionary income available in the U.S. That one-third of the population, over 50, control one-half of the discretionary income, being that which is needed, or that which is available over and above the expenses to live. Families. This one will blow your minds. In 1953, 92% of all American households were original two-parent spouse homes. You got that? Much like what's probably represented in this room. You want to take a guess on what it is today? Somebody take a guess. 40? You're too high. 1986, it's 14%. You are in an absolute minority if you're one of those first figures. And, of course, we think that may be distorted, but it's not, because most of the people we associate with are in the same category as we are. We're a very small minority if you're an original two-spouse family. Here's some stuff on women. In 1960, 70% of all women between 20 and 24 were married. In 1985, only 40% are married. For the first time in our history, there are more women registered in universities, enrolled in universities, than there are men. First time in our history as a country, there are more women. 52% of our college enrollment are women. 57% of all married women work outside the home. And if you're in the book-selling business, 83% of Christian books are purchased by women. 83% of all Christian books are purchased by women. There's a little phrase, and I think it's quite true. If you want to reach women, you know, you can do it through books and materials. You want to reach men, you give them a tape. Because men just don't read as much, but they do have that tape recorder in the car, a lot of them, and they're willing to plug that in as they drive back and forth to work. So if you've got somebody you're trying to influence for Christ, you may want to, a man, you may want to try the tape route. Okay. Now, all that is just to kind of give you a little picture of the culture that we're trying to penetrate. There are three great influences happening in our country today that you and I have to deal with. Secularism. Now let me give you just a brief word on secularism, because it's a kind of becoming a one of these coined words that we hear about and sometimes we don't understand. It's not all that complicated. I think basically secularism is the moving away from religious ideas and institutions. It's the process by which we move away from religious ideas and institutions. So where our country was founded with somewhat of a biblical base and foundation, we now find all of that is being fragmented, and we're moving away from those religious ideas and those religious institutions that had a major impact upon the country. And so anything that's involved in that process is secularism. There's another great influence that we're having to deal with in our world, and in particularly in the U.S. today, and it's the phrase pluralism. Now, pluralism simply, very simply, is just the multiplicity of choices that face you on any issue. See, just take the whole religious issue. You want to be a Baptist? What kind of a Baptist do you want to be? I mean, we can give you every flavor and variety. You want to be a Lutheran? We can give you the liberal Lutheran. We can give you the conservative Lutheran. You want to be a Presbyterian? You know, the same thing. There's just a multi, that's just in religious choices. How about as a couple? What are the choices you face? Do you have a multiplicity of choices you face as a couple as to what you're going to give your time to? You bet. You can give it to community affairs, political affairs, religious affairs. I mean, there is no end to the choices. By the way, I think this is why our teenagers are absolutely overwhelmed. The multiplicity of choices they face for the future, for what they could do, for what they could give their lives to, for what they could get involved in today, it's overwhelming. Pluralism, we face it all the time. Life was a lot simpler back there on the farm. There weren't so many choices. 5 o'clock, you get up and you get out there and get the chores done. 8:30, you go down, catch the bus and go to school. 4 o'clock, you come home, you do more chores. And, you know, life was a lot simpler. There weren't so many choices. And it was survival. It was survival. I laugh trying to, when I look at my kids and you talk to them about going out to get a little part-time job and so on. My dad made it real simple for me. He said, you know, you're going into high school next year. Would you like to wear clothes? Didn't take much to get me out to get a job. You know, I figured if I was going to have some kind of decent clothes to wear, it was real simple. But he didn't do that because he was mean. He did it because he couldn't afford to pay for my clothing. And so life is a lot simpler. Pluralism is a thing that we face. And when you're dealing with people, just remember, you're offering them only one of many choices in the things that they could get involved in and give their lives to. And the third influence, great influence, is privatization. And basically this is the withdrawing into your little private world. Everybody is kind of pulling out, and you protect yourself. And it happens even in our best evangelical churches. People are getting very choosy and very protective about themselves. And so they withdraw into their own family unit or even within themselves. And this privatization is an issue that we're facing in our society today. Okay, well, what's the answer? What's it going to take to break through, you know, with all this stuff and everything that's going on? What in the world is the answer? So let's take a look at what the Bible has to say about that over in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. If you would turn there, I would appreciate it. I'd like you to follow along. First Corinthians 9:19. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jew, I became a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, and so on and so forth. And then drop down to verse 24. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. I'd like to suggest there are three things in this little passage from verse 19 to the end that will really help us in terms of breaking through with the gospel into the society in which we live. Now, the first is in verse 19. Paul says, I make myself a slave that I might win many. Now, you're all familiar with the phrase lifestyle evangelism. And isn't that a nice, comfortable phrase? Because what it suggests is that I can just kind of live my life and glow like a little moonbeam beaming off all of the joy of Jesus, and people are going to come to Christ in great hordes. Right? Wrong. It doesn't happen, does it? See, Paul here made a very definitive choice. He said, I make myself a slave in order to win many. This is a decisive act of my will. I'm going to engage my energies in winning many people to Christ. This is not a laissez-faire approach. Paul has figured it out that it really does cost if you're going to try and make an impact into the world. And so he says, I make myself a slave by choice. I've been teaching a Sunday school class on this subject, an adult Sunday school class, and we got talking about this last week, and I had them read the passage. I said, now what does it say in verse 19? It says, well, it means that Paul decided he was going to serve people. I said, well, does your translation use the word servant? And there are a few that do use the word servant. But the Greek says slave. And a slave's a lot different than a servant. I mean, he's in bondage to his master. And Paul says, I make myself a slave to the gospel. I'm in bondage to the gospel. I am going to commit myself to win many by choice. I came to Christ when I was 22 years old, and I came out of a secular home, zero background in terms of the church. A week after I was saved, I was sitting down in the front row, and the deacon who had led me to Christ a week before, he came roaring down the aisle, greeted my brother-in-law and sister who were influential in my coming to Christ, and then he turned to me and he said, Bob, have you witnessed to anybody this week? And the only thing I could think of was that previous week I'd been in court, I'd been charged with a felony, and I'd had witnesses there. And I must have had this very confused. I mean, I had no idea what in the world he was talking about, except that somehow he must have found out that I was in court the week before. And my sister, you know, she was much more spiritual. 6 months ahead of me in the Lord, she dug her elbow in my side and she said, that means, did you tell anybody about what you did last week in terms of accepting Christ? And I went away from that service that morning and I thought, if that's part of the Christian life, then I'm going to commit myself to it. If that means you share Christ with people, and that's obvious, you know, that's what you're to do, then I'm going to do it. So I engaged for the next about 9 months in evangelism. Now, my form was not all that great. My methodology of evangelism was to go to happy hour with the guys, and in those days I had no idea of self-control or limitations, and so we would get to happy hour, which really isn't all that happy, but we would sit around and we'd scoff a few beers and a few more and a few more, and then I'd tell them how Jesus had really changed my life. And they'd all smile and say, sure, chef, that's great, you know, and then the bartender would throw us all out drunk. And then the next night we'd turn up for happy hour and I'd tell them again how Jesus really changed my life. Didn't see any fruit. I couldn't understand, you know, why nothing was happening. About 9 months later, I met the navigators, and of course, they began to give me some help and get me on track. In fact, my introduction to the navigators were two navigators sharing the bridge illustration with a non-Christian. Now, the non-Christian, he didn't want to have anything to do with it, and he got up and left. But they were drawing that bridge illustration out on a napkin, and boy, in my heart, I thought, if I could get a hold of that, I could use that. That's exactly what I'm looking for. And pretty soon they could see that I obviously was interested, and I said, hey, could I take that napkin? And they said, oh, sure, you know. And of course, they knew they had a live one as soon as they, and they began a little follow-up. And my next step to witnessing was they invited me to go out. They, in those days, we had no idea of targeting on a campus or a military base. Or what they did was we met on Sunday afternoons. We'd go out into a park. And so they, I said, well, look, you know, I've never done anything like that. They said, it's okay. We train you thoroughly. And you just come on and show up, and we'll send you out with a guy who knows what he's doing. We'll train you thoroughly. So I went Sunday afternoon, and I got hooked up with a guy, and we went out. And there was an old boy. We were in a park, an open-air park, and there was an old boy over on the bench that looked like he'd been there all night. And we got over there and started to, Paul, the fellow I was with, said to him, sir, we're out talking to people about spiritual things. Are you interested in spiritual things? And the guy said, no. And Paul said, you know, you're the first man I've ever met in my life that's not interested in why aren't you interested in spiritual things? So for the next 30 minutes, the guy began to tell us why he wasn't interested in spiritual things. He really was, obviously. But I was ready to pull Paul away. So I thought, this is great. And Paul then began to present the bridge to him. And the guy didn't come to Christ, but I thought, this is fantastic. I'm going to really take advantage of this training. The next week, I showed up Sunday afternoon, and they were pairing everybody up and said, let's see, Bob, you were here last week. Okay, you're a trainer. You take Gene this week, okay? And that was my introduction to evangelism. But I did make a thorough commitment to be a slave to the gospel in those early days. I can remember once I got on track and began to see it, there was a commitment. And I told the Lord, in fact, I was trying to get into university after that, and I told the Lord, I said, Lord, if you get me in to that course, if there's nobody else on that campus, I guarantee you I will be your witness. I got accepted into that course the first day of classes. This was an unusual deal. It was a program put together for 2 years, kind of an experimental deal, in Parks and Recreation Administration up in Canada. And they'd bring in lecturers from the U.S. for 2 or 3 days at a time. My job, since I was one of the seniors in terms of age, was to host the lecturer. I'd take them over for coffee breaks. The first day, we were having a session on personal motivation and group dynamics. So I, at the break, I take the fellow over to the coffee bar and we get a cup of coffee. And he said, Bob, why are you in this course? And I had told the Lord, I said, now, Lord, I won't fudge. I will witness. And I thought, well, I'm just going to tell this guy that I like kids. And that's why I'm in a parks and recreation course. And it was as if God said, Bob, remember your commitment. And so I shared with him. I said, well, 2 years ago I came to Christ, and it's really changed my life, and I've been trying to follow God's will since then, and I just believe that God has led to this. And I explained my testimony to him and so on. He said, that is absolutely fantastic. When we go back to the class, would you share that with the whole class? A slave to the gospel. That happened twice that week in the first week of classes. Those 2 years were probably the best 2 years of my life in terms of personal witnessing. Every day, it was another opportunity, another. But it came as a result of a commitment to be God's witness, a slave to the gospel. Not a casual, laissez-faire approach, but a real firm commitment. Okay, now look beyond verse 19. Look at verse 20 through about 23. You know the little passage in here. He talks about becoming a Jew to the Jews, and so on and so forth. And basically, what he's saying here is that we need to have an adaptive approach to people. Because you're going to run into some people who, like the little survey showed you over here, are the religious lost. And there's a certain approach to be used with the religious lost. You're going to run into other people who are the secular lost. And you're going to have to be adaptive there. So there needs to be flexibility in our approach. You know, when we get into this business of cultural flexibility or lifestyle evangelism, a lot of the conservatives say, oh, you mean you're now going to go to the pub and drink beer in order to win many to Christ? No, that's just taking it away out of context. It's becoming flexible in the culture in which you live in order to win. I was out in California a while back, and there was a fellow that they had invited for the music program, did a beautiful job, and I got talking to him afterwards. He had come from Florida. He'd been with a traveling group and in contemporary music. And the Presbyterian Church of America had wanted to establish this little new fellowship in California. So they'd gotten a hold of him and a pastor and said, we want you to go out there and we want you to do something totally different in terms of reaching people. Don't do the traditional. So they went out and basically just started to pray and try and figure out what to do. So the first thing they did was they hired a marketing research firm to do a market research in a geographic area. And they learned all kinds of things from this secular marketing research firm. One of the things, they ended up naming this the North Cherry Presbyterian Church. I said, now look, you said your goal was to win the lost here. How in the world do you go into California with Presbyterian Church? I mean, that's about as straight as you're going to get. And they said, well, in this, as they did their survey in this area, one thing that the people in California are really concerned about is cults. And so they, if they were going to attend a church, they would want something that's Presbyterian or something that's a little more orthodox if they were going to go. Now, this came from people. Well, I thought, now that's innovative. First of all, just to even use your heads to go get somebody to do that research for you. The other thing that they did was that on Sunday mornings, they don't have a worship teaching service. Sunday mornings, the program is totally geared to outreach. Well, my goodness, what are we going to do about worship and teaching? Those of us that need to go to church on Sunday morning for worship and teaching. I mean, this is heresy. They do that Wednesday. They have their feeding and teaching and worship on Wednesday night. They gear the whole program Sunday morning, contemporary music, the whole approach is geared to winning the lost. Bring your friends and their families and their kids, because this is the wildest show in town. You know, how flexible are we? That's all Paul's saying here. To the Jews, I became a Jew. He says, I figured out my culture and those whom I'm with, and whatever it takes, not compromising God's truth, but whatever it takes in terms of friendship and relationship, I will do it. Because I am a slave to the gospel, and I don't want all these trappings to hinder this approach. I was listening to a tape by Joe Aldrich, who wrote the book Lifestyle Evangelism. And it really helped me when he said that very early in his seminary training that he and his wife made a commitment that the major part of their social life would go toward the non-Christians, no matter how much pressure the church put on them. And if you know Joe's history, he's had some very significant church assignments. He is the president of Multnomah School of the Bible. But the majority of his social life is invested in the non-Christians. Now, that's the kind of commitment it's going to take from you and I in order to penetrate. Otherwise, we can just hold hands in the comfortable holy huddle and just let life merrily roll over us. Or we can decide that God is really serious about reaching the lost and he wants us to be part of it. Okay, and then finally, in this passage in 1 Corinthians 9, you notice verses 24 to the end. And here, basically, Paul is talking about a disciplined lifestyle. He's disciplined in order to win the lost. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think it means just what it says. That life, if you just roll with the punches, you're going to be buried by life. Because of the pluralism and the multiplicity of choices that every one of us face, we're going to have to be ruthless with the time we have available to invest. And quite frankly, there are probably a lot of activities that we're investing in that are not all that profitable. They don't really pay off the greatest dividends, both in terms of our own growth and in terms of outreach. And my testimony would be that when I am aggressively involved in evangelism and when God is using me in that area, it seems like all the other areas of my Christian growth get lined up. Bible study becomes more exciting. The disciplines become more exciting. The quiet time becomes more meaningful. But when I haven't been sharing Christ and there hasn't been that opportunity, it seems like I can get in a little bit of a slide there, and it's not all that much fun. Now, turn with me, if you would, on this idea of discipline to win, over to 1 Peter chapter 2, and then we're going to end up here Let's see, Larry, you got any announcements this morning? Good. I'm going to go right till 10:30, so hang with me. Go over to 1 Peter chapter 2. Now, I don't have time to develop it, but let it be suffice to say that the Great Commission is rooted in the Old Testament. In Genesis 12, he talks to Abraham. He says, I want you to leave. I'm going to make you a great name. And through you, we're going to bless all the nations of the world. All the peoples of the world are going to be blessed. And that blessing is the blessing of salvation, the gift of salvation. That through Abraham, his name will be great. Through his seed, there's going to be a great blessing. And here we pick up in this passage, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. That's evangelism, by the way. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Now listen to this. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us. Now that little phrase there toward the end is lifestyle evangelism. Discipline. See, Paul says back there in the 1 Corinthians 9 passage that he beat his body. He brought it into discipline. Well, what are the disciplines? Well, one of them is to abstain from evil. One of the disciplines that he talks about is that our lives need to be different. The way that we glorify God and the people begin to notice is that we're different. We're different in our speech. We're different in our conduct. We're different in the things that we will do and the things that we won't do. And most of all, we're different by the way that we love people and that we give ourselves to people and that we approach people. Now turn one more page in your Bible over to 1 Peter chapter 3. This verse everybody loves. Verse 15. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. Now that is really great, isn't it? Always be ready to give an answer. Are we ever ready to give an answer? Man, we got more answers than they got questions. We're always ready to give an answer. But notice the first part of the verse. But set Christ apart as Lord. The reason that people want to ask you some questions should be that they see your life is radically different because you're living under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Now, I really believe this is why the church is somewhat ineffective today. Because most of the non-Christians look over and they say, hey, if that's all you got to offer, I don't want it. Man, they backbite over there. I've had dealings with Christian people and in business, and they're no different than anybody else. But see, if Jesus is truly the Lord of our lives and we're living under his lordship and his sovereignty, they'll be lined up to ask us a reason of the hope that is within us. So one of the questions you may want to ask yourself in your neighborhood and in your job, if people aren't asking the question, then go back to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Am I really living under the Lordship of Jesus Christ in everything that I do, in everything that I say? Be ready to give an answer to any man who asks you a hope that is within you. Evangelism really becomes fun when you get into that kind of a posture. I was up in Canada a while back and I had been visiting with some relatives and we sat down to have lunch. And this doesn't happen very often, but one of my nephews, his parents came to lunch. And as we sat there, he had been to a service that morning that I'd spoke at and he pulled out some notes that he had taken. And he said, now I want to ask you a question. You use the phrase, born again. What does that mean? And there's my dad and everybody sitting right there. And I thought that was the neatest thing in the world. My brother called me I was going up to Canada last May, and he called me in April. He said, Bob, I got this kid who works for me. And he just called me, and he's really confused. He's looking for God. And when you come next month, will you tell him how to find God? And so when I got up there in May, we had the opportunity to sit down and share. Be ready to give an answer. But see, the answer doesn't come without, first of all, living the life before people that they can identify that you've got some answers. And that comes as a result of that lordship living. Okay, let's quit right there. But let me suggest three possible applications to you. You may already have something for yourself, but let me just suggest. There are a lot of new people here. There are a lot of people you've not been to a conference like this before. And we're about halfway through the conference. You can't come to a conference like this without God speaking to you. It's not the wonderful speakers. But just being in this environment with people who love Jesus, who are trying to make their lives count, we know that God is speaking. And it may be this whole issue of lordship is where you're hung up. That you, as a husband and a wife, you need to resolve this issue. That from here on out, we're going to live under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And it's hard to talk about these things, particularly if you're in your 40s or thereabouts, and you know, all of a sudden you're confronted with these and you haven't faced these issues before. And you as a husband and wife need to take a walk around the island here this afternoon or right after lunch or whatever and really talk about this. Are our lives really under the lordship of Jesus Christ? Are we living the kind of life that we know we ought to live? Are we willing to commit ourselves to live that way from here on out? Under the lordship of Jesus Christ. A second application is you may want a purpose to be a slave to the gospel. That up until now, your approach to evangelism and witnessing and sharing has rather been, well, if the opportunity comes, I'll take it. Rather than creating some opportunities. Being a slave to the gospel. Taking the initiative to go out there and get those neighbors in your home. Or to go to the racquetball court and spend the time to develop some new relationships or whatever it takes to put ourselves in the way of the non-Christians so they got to run into us. For most of us, we live in these little Christian ghettos that we have and we can't break out. But if you decide to make yourself a slave to the gospel, you're going to figure out how to really go out and start making those kind of contacts, develop those kind of friendships. A third application may be, and it fits with the second, to purpose to make room in your schedule for outreach. To make room in your schedule for outreach. See, we schedule everything else. We get, you know, Sunday we go to church, Sunday morning we go to church, Sunday afternoon we have a nap, Sunday night we're back in church if it's Baptist, whatever. Monday night's Bible study, Wednesday night's prayer meeting. We schedule everything. Well, do you think we could afford one night a week where we really purpose? We're going to use that night to go take some neighbors to a show. It doesn't need to be spiritual. Some non-Christian people, just to put yourself in the way. Go join a tennis club, a bowling league, anything. But get yourself into a posture to influence and to impact. And maybe that's what we need to do. You know, as Christians, we live awfully busy lives, feeding ourselves, getting fat, getting obese. And we actually need that discipline to get out there amongst the lost. Well, we've said enough on that, and let's quit right there and go have a cup of coffee. Father, thank you for the day, for this morning. Thank you for your word. We thank you for the example we see in the life of Jesus, where he came preaching and teaching. He had time to build a team and to be an equipper, to help those men be able to have their own ministries. And yet at the same time, he never left his preaching and teaching. He kept at the same things that he exhorts us to. We thank you for the example of the Apostle Paul. And we see that his life was totally captivated for the sake of the gospel. And Lord, we're ashamed at times when we think of our own lives and just how much time we spend on ourselves. Father, help us to find that right balance. And we realize that we're under tremendous pressure in terms of the utilization of our time. There are many choices to be made. Help us, Lord, to make the choices that would be pleasing to you. We commit our time to you now. In Jesus' name, amen.